Hi, Thomas.
Hello,
welcome
Adam.
To EHEX FM. Yeah, exactly. I have to welcome you first.
Thank you for having me.
And what was your first computer?
My first computer. I think it was Intel 468.
Wow.
40 megahertz.
It sounds like yesterday.
Yes, it had whopping 300 something megabytes of disk for.
Yeah.
4 megabytes of RAM.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was the first computer. I don't remember. It was at that part, I didn't know the names of the parts that much. I remember these things because everyone talked about this in my hometown. So these were the important parameters.
And, are you from Krakow?
No, I'm originally from a town called Ożarów. Ożarów is like a town of about 4,500 people. The life over there essentially orbits around a cement plant, so there's one big factory. Mm. And so, yeah, it was a very lovely place to live in and be, you know, grow up in.
Is it near of Krakow?
It's near absolutely nothing that people usually remember or know. So
I know Krakow, Katowice, Gdańsk, and Warsaw. This is the main conference. But I was the least in Warsaw. Most times in Gdańsk, Krakow or Gdańsk, one of those.
Yeah, so if I were to tell this on a map somewhere, I would say halfway between Krakow and Warsaw, but more to the east.
Okay.
So it's like if you know roughly, you know, the way the Wisła
the train
River
line.
Goes.
It goes the train line from Katowice to Gdańsk.
Completely different section of Poland.
Oh, okay. Then because this is not a story for the podcast, but I spent 2 days in a train, high-speed train in Poland, and I visited like 3 or 4 cities and 3 conferences because Polish people are crazy about Java conferences. So there were like 3 conferences in 1 week. And this is why I know the train line very well, so well that I actually advised some Polish developers which train to pick. It was 2 years ago, so my knowledge. But I have the app. The Pendolino train. What I took.
Oh yeah, I never taken Pendolino. To
you
be
see,
honest.
Yeah. It was the best experience ever. I would say.
I've heard amazing things about Polish rail, and I've heard.
But you
some
are from Poland, right? Not that
well.
You are from a different city and a different country, and you know.
Yeah, I'm based in the UK, but I am from Poland. Yes, it's just that you know. Ożarów is nowhere close. I mean, it is close to a rail line, but a very regional one. So I never really used train as my primary communication method. That's why I don't know that much about it. I hear about it, and I hear how, you know, it struggled in the past and how it's struggling sometimes now, but also how it's developing in, well, you know, impressive ways.
Yeah, for me,
places.
It was no struggle. It was just impressive. Everything worked. So it was.
I'm pleased to hear that. That's why, you know, it's nice to hear this journey as well, as in like the journey of the rail in Poland as well. So,
yeah.
I'm pleased
and
that
beautiful
your experience
landscape.
Was nice.
Why I actually ask is because it was like almost no stations, and in the center of Poland was beautiful. It's just, I don't know, it looked great. It was, there was no cities, it's just no large fields and everything green and nice skies. So I had just good memories, so it was nice.
Yeah, and it's pretty nice also. So, the disadvantage of living in such a remote place, I mean, it's not very, very remote. It's just not close to the biggest places, right? Is that, well, you're far from those places. The advantage of it is that you get more and more, beautiful views. So it's close to the mountains we call Świętokrzyskie Mountains, which are small, but really lovely. And because of that, we have a lot of this bumpy landscape around us. So you won't have like flat land around. Everything will be just, bumpy, and you will have small valleys, small mounds. So
what I remember
really
was flat in my case. I had to work as well, but the landscape was more or less flat. So I was not near your city.
But
what did you do with the computer?
Sorry?
What you did with the computer, you know, with the 486 computer. What was your first action with the computer?
The things that I remember from the first actions were, I remember we had a CD with games, so we played a lot with that one. I remember,
what was your favorite game?
I don't think I had a favorite game from that time. Actually, I had an Atari before that. It's just that kind of, you know, when you ask computer, I'm thinking PC. But on Atari, we played River Ride a lot with my family. But it was one of those.
What was it?
It's like a plane going over a river. And there's like a battle that you have with ships, with helicopters, with other planes and stuff like that.
Which Atari was it? 800?
I don't remember. I was too small to remember.
Yeah, what's wrong
that.
With you? You have to remember your first computers, everything. This is the basic preparation for AirHacks FM podcast, you know. This is the most important things, you know. Favorite games, favorite Great. Computers, and a little bit of Java. So
now I feel unprepared. Thank you.
And okay, cool. Because I think if you started with 486, so you are very young, a junior developer. But if you had Atari before, so you're excused. Have you actually programmed something on the Atari or just played games?
I mean, we had a basic manual. At that time, I didn't click with computers in that way, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It was, I didn't think of them, of that as an option even. Mm-hmm. It was just like an entertainment machine. So, yeah, you know, you put a cassette in. We loaded games with cassettes, right? Mm-hmm. Cassettes, yeah. For some of the listeners, these are like plastic containers with magnetic tape inside.
And
you put them in and then you leave the room, you don't breathe so that you don't break the loading mechanism, because it would break quite frequently. I've heard even somebody found a bug in it a few years back and made a fix for, you know, loading of the data from cassettes for Ataris.
You apparently even have to adjust the head, you remember that?
I remember that one.
To have a clear sound, otherwise it wouldn't load. So there was even software for that. Now I remember where you could load. There was like a sound, you know, and you can adjust the head of the cassette player.
But yeah,
but these
anyway,
are the best practices, you know, for developers on AIKFM.
We had a basic manual at home, but I never really learned how to code. We tried to, but it's like when you don't understand what's going on, you're trying to just rewrite a game, then sometimes it will work, sometimes it will not work. So it never clicked for me at that time. I think it never really occurred to me that I would be working in software until, 18, something like that.
Okay.
This was the first time that actually something clicked for me.
Was it the first time you programmed something with 17?
No, I mean, I've been making some websites, things like very simple things in the past. I remember, have you ever played with Logo, like, you know, drawing with a turtle?
Yeah, so
I remember
left,
making...
Left, right, go, forward,
I remember making a clock with that. I remember making scripts in...
A clock is crazy, so you need some math. You know,
it took a while to get it right, and then like cleaning up was also difficult because it wouldn't follow the same coordinates back and forth and stuff like that. So, and then like, you know, when I did secondhand, I remember that it didn't align, so I had to compensate for the speed of the computer. So that a minute takes a minute. I remember sitting for like, you know, not even a minute. A minute wasn't enough. I did like, you know, 5 minutes and counting how long it took me to do the 5 minutes so that I could make a compensation and adjust so that it actually takes a minute to draw a second hand for a minute, right? I remember these things. This was pretty fun. I remember like, you know, doing some scripts in Windows to just, you know, add folders, stuff like this. This was the type of things we were learning at
the description basic. So
computer science.
QBasic or whatever. The Windows.
No, it was like command scripts or bat scripts in Windows, right? So very like, you know, simple things like this. So I've been doing things like this at school, but also I wasn't really exposed to more challenging things at that time. So I never went beyond this.
Creating a clock with Logo is a pretty advanced, I would say. I mean, this is like, you know, the Logo aside, but it is not trivial. I mean, you could is it similar to SVG a little bit, right? Logo, you could
say. I'd say, you know, there's kind of, it is advanced, but if nobody tells you it's advanced, it's not advanced for you, right? It's just
but now we
having fun,
that,
right?
I told you right now that you built advanced logo stuff. You are the enterprise logo developer.
Yeah, and then but then, like, you know, there were computer science competitions at that time at school, and we called them Olympics.
Okay.
And I took part in various, many of them when I was younger. Like, I did maths, physics, English. I remember German. I remember computer science. I remember traffic codex. There was a competition for how well the youth know, you know, the rules of road acts, essentially, in the country.
Oh,
so
uh-huh.
So I've
and
done,
you won something?
Lots of them. Yeah, a few, but never computer science. Computer science always kind of outgrew me because I didn't have the training in, like, you know, the algorithms or structures. Mm-hmm. And when I saw it, it was like, you know, yeah, I'm not good for that, and I would not go that far with that. But yeah, these were fun. You know, it was always enjoyable to take part in those. So, yeah.
Sure. So you started the scripting on the second machine because this, I think it was the 486.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened then? So what was the trajectory from scripting to the first programming language?
I think the first things I started doing at that time was websites, right? So this was, second part of the 90s. So making a website. It was becoming increasingly easier because this was kind of time of Front Page Express being available. So you could start with this, but you could also try building things. There were first courses in how to make that. So I think the primary objective at that time was trying to express myself. Obviously, you know, they were sometimes pretty, sometimes ugly. You made many of them, and most of them are thankfully lost to the time. These predated Web Archive probably even. But it was like still more for my own enjoyment until... So I actually joined... I was part of a kind of a Christian community and they needed somebody to look after a website and after their mailing list. And I think this is kind of how things happened to meet me, right? I never was really like, oh, I really want to do computers. Computers are what I want to do, and this is the thing. It was more, oh, I can make something that's useful for others, and that's kind of where it, that's where it just clicked for me because it turned out that I know how to make things, or I can learn how to make things and make it useful for others. So this was probably my primary driver. So around the age of 18, 19, I started looking after a mailing list. It was running in Acartis, I believe, the software. So there was a server, and it turns out that another lucky thing was that one of my friends actually was involved in these things, in this community on the national level. So he connected me with, you know, you can be an admin over here. And then it kind of escalated in this direction. But also at this time, I was choosing uni. So I went towards computing science, data management.
Okay.
And
And what did you do during your study? So on what programming languages you learned? So this was the website, I assume, a little bit JavaScript, jQuery, I guess, right?
I was primarily focused on the HTML and PHP at that time because the websites were running, everything was running PHP at that time. I really don't know. I think it's still running quite a lot of the internet, right? Even though I've never came
Facebook.
Back. I never went back to it after I moved away. So I actually did two faculties. So the first one we were learning Perl. I remember we were learning Bash, but like the basic, because this wasn't like a strictly computer science type of a faculty. It was more in economics.
Okay.
But then we started doing Java.
Wow.
And Java kind of stuck with me from the beginning. It was kind of the moment when Java 5 was about to be released. So I still did Java 4, Java 5 things at that time.
So you started with annotations.
Yeah, I remember, and the generics.
Generics were 1.4, or 1-3.
I think they were 1-3.
They were earlier. 1-3, 1-4 was basically nothing, as I remember. It was just performance improvements and stuff like that. And 1-5 was a big thing. This was the annotations and enums.
Yeah, but you could hear, you could feel the improvements. I mean, like, you know, it was like in Java 5, it felt like you could express what you want to express.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I wasn't doing anything very fancy or very advanced at that time. It was just, you know, university stuff. But around that time, yeah. So I did the Java, and then I think this was kind of the last language. Well, we did SQL, obviously. There was a course in SQL, but that was kind of everything because I went more towards the management branch of the faculty. But in the meantime, I started the computer science at AGH University of Technology, and that one was a solid, like, you know, very focused technologically faculty. And one of the more valued ones. But yeah, I remember we did Pascal. I remember we did obviously Python. I remember Erlang. I remember Icon. Icon was fun.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we did quite a lot of stuff. C, C++, some Ruby. I think I tried Ruby, but it kind of didn't stick with me at that time, at least. So, yeah, it just spread out on multiple things at that time already because, yeah, we were doing various things. We were, like, we were programming HPC classes and doing some multi-criterion optimization algorithms. It was just spreading out into multiple technologies at that time.
You are absolutely right. Generics were introduced with JDK 1.5, not earlier. And the crazy part is in JSR 14, this was confused, the JSR, Java Specification Request, was started in 1998. And so they there was always, work around generics, but it took like 6 years to release them. So they were final in Java 5. What I thought is that generics were JDK 1.3, but I was wrong. JDK 1.5, Java 5 were generics. 2004. So just 22 years of generics.
Cool. Yeah, I vaguely remember this one because the company, I think I can say this because the company, well, it doesn't really exist anymore. Their software doesn't run anymore. But I remember 2016 when I joined one of the companies, Open Market, and we still had software running on Java 4, 1.4. Mm-hmm. As we said at this time, right? So yeah, I remember that one.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh, the deployment over there was also fun, but I think we got it into a much better place. I remember I managed to upgrade to Java 8 on the last day before Java 8 went end of life.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had one day of being up to date. That was rewarding. It took me 4 years to get there.
So you took you 4 years to convince the management to get there, and you spent one day of upgrading, or?
No, it was a more complex thing that was happening. So essentially, the work was happening. It's just that I jumped to previous places, which also probably deserve mentioning. But I think the part that's kind of, I have very fond memories of Open Market because.
Is this a company called Open Market?
Yes. It no longer exists. So essentially we were acquired soon after I decided to leave. It was acquired by a competition.
Mm-hmm.
And then essentially the competition took over everything and kind of ingested the company. So the name doesn't exist anymore.
What was Open Market about? So
Open Market was a, let's put it like corporate messaging gateway.
Okay.
So they were building solutions for both marketing, but also 2FA and two-way communication, but also premium text, charity support. It was like, you know, everything that did SMS. They were doing it. They were global, I think, sending messages everywhere but North Korea.
Is it UK company?
it was a company that was, so it was, part of it was started in the UK, and but the open market itself, I think, started in Seattle and then took over a company called MX, I believe.
Okay.
From the UK. So we had offices in US and in the UK.
And you helped them Java. Was it your first job? Your first?
No, this was my third job, actually. But I think the first one in which I, you know, grew this much. I think I grew everywhere because each of my jobs had amazing things to them, right? But this one is like the one that I learned a lot more than I thought that I could learn. And mm-hmm. I achieved way more than I thought that I could achieve. Mm-hmm. And also, this is the time when my adventure with AWS started. So it's also...
And your first job?
The third job.
The third. And what was the first job? It's also about Java?
Oh, yes. So essentially, the first job, I was a graduate at Motorola Solutions.
Wow.
I was working on a... Well, one of their communication systems. I won't get into details over here. It was mm-hmm. 4 years around the same stack. It was an experience in a sense that I had a very nice team. We were very motivated. We've built things, we've challenged things, but we never really went into, you know, we were never sold or, you know, rolled out mm-hmm. anywhere because mm-hmm. it was one of the new things that were happening and the requirements were changing along the way, which meant that essentially things were shifting so rapidly that...
Was it also Java?
It was also Java.
So what was actually your first Java application you wrote for your... You learned this during your study? Yeah, you said it. So it was like assignment or you did something for you or...
No, really assignment. It's like the thing is I never really build much for myself. Mm-hmm. I think usually, you know, ideas are usually the tricky ones for me and also the driver. So building something for myself, I would not be as interested ever, as I said. But if somebody needed something, I would do it immediately. So I remember, for instance, writing extensions to, I think it was called PHP Nuke, the mm-hmm. CMS. Mm-hmm. So I remember writing extensions so that we could do something, you know, for the community. Mm-hmm. But for myself, I really don't remember building anything specifically for myself for any particular use in a very, very long time. I was only focused, like, you know, on the challenges that were coming from some other people or other organizations. So, for instance, at work, building this communication system and configuration management solution for it. I remember at the uni, I remember when we built, for instance, the I think it was called a I don't know the English name, but in Polish the equivalent would be like an island optimization mm-hmm. algorithm. So you think, you know, like the genetics algorithm for optimization that would also have like a sub world. So mm-hmm. Your agent or like, you know, the entity in the system could either they would collide and obviously, you know, challenge itself, but they could also procreate. But also if they had enough energy, they could expend some of it to migrate to a different world mm-hmm. and then start optimization over there.
And you implemented this with Java?
I started with Python, mm-hmm. and then I learned that I don't know how to manage memory in Python, so I quickly switched into Java, and suddenly things started working, so that was a great experience.
But was it, this is interesting, was then for you Java simpler than Python? Or
I don't think it was easier, simpler, in terms of syntax. I think this is something that I really liked about Python, that you could write very simply. I think what I struggled with at that time was more, how do I understand what's working or not working? How do I name things? And I already knew how these things worked in Java. Okay. So this made it much simpler for me because also bear in mind, I think this was more of a, you know, knowing that Java is strictly typed, I actually really like strictly typed languages. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So this was also something that made it much simpler because, like, you know, how do I know what I have in every time? Like, you know, why do things slow down? Why am I not releasing things over here? The boundaries were much simpler for me to capture mm-hmm. in Java, I think. That's why I decided to move to that one. At the same time, I, for instance, remember we did like a internship contract generation system for our university, and we did it in Python with Django. Mm-hmm. And that was also a great experience at that time. But I think I already had my failures with the, you know, optimization algorithm mm-hmm. at that time, so that I knew where I had to be more cautious.
But this was an interesting, actually, project, a really interesting project. And,
Oh, yeah. It was fun. I remember I did a experiment on it on trying to recommend investments. Mm-hmm. So I was using like previous 5 days of stock exchange performance of some of the, you know, stocks. Mm-hmm. I would recommend what to do in the next day, and then I would compare whether it would work or not. And yeah, it worked. I think one day ahead, it was pretty good, as in, you know, marginally positive in terms of results. So that was kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm. So you did some interesting project during your university time. Mm-hmm. First job at Motorola. It was also Java, right?
It was also Java.
Embedded Java or server-side Java?
Server-side Java.
Hey, cool.
First server-side Java, then at some point I moved to a team building an Android device.
And was it the server-side Java was like Java E-related or
Tomcat? Sorry?
Was it Java J2E, Tomcat?
Yeah, we did. Did we do Tomcat at the time? I think we started with Tomcat, and then towards the end, Netty was around, and I think we already started using Netty.
Oh, this is a high-performance networking. Okay, cool.
But yeah, in general, it was more of a, like, the system that we were building was for configuration, so it was a relatively basic CRUD. That was capturing things, but then it was using the what was the name of the protocol? Network Management Protocol and NPMC.
The simple SNMP, Network Management Protocol, SNMP.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it was used to send the configuration to devices.
There was lots of buzz around that. I remember. Also, at that time, I was also asked a lot about SNMP, and there were Java libraries also about SNMP. Mm-hmm. And then it died somehow, interestingly. Now I remember that. So the SNMP was big.
Yeah, because there was kind of a mixture of things. So we were doing the configuration side, and then there was I think, C-sharp written.
That's even SNMP for J. So this is what I remember. They're still around.
Yeah, I think we used that one. And then I remember, so the first one that we did, it's like the company made an investment in tooling, and they wanted to prove that the tooling works, as in there was a kind of no-code solution for building Spring applications, Spring CRUDs, that mm-hmm. Didn't quite work. So essentially it worked partially, and then The first thing that I've done for it was, because this was just after I joined when we were told to use this thing, mm-hmm. I made like Ant script. So I had Ant jobs that were connected to Maven, even, I believe, that were
but
tasked
Ant
with.
Was not that bad, right? So Ant was fine.
I have nothing bad to say about Ant. It was more like a kind of. It was an imperative language in XML in a way.
But it was like more like, you know, this is the task and execute Java, and it just run one task after another task.
Yeah, yeah.
And for that, it was actually. So I'm just stunned that it just dry out. So it was no more that popular. Maven is. I use Maven all the time. But there is also some room for Ant, I would say. If
I don't think it went away completely, as in it still pops up every now and then, but probably still legacy applications.
Yeah,
because, exactly. But it was our savior in a way, because the tool that we're told to use was very buggy. Mm-hmm. So what I was doing is I had one Ant script that was run to clean up the system before using the tool mm-hmm. to add data changes, and then I had another one to clean up after it made it output so that it actually worked. Mm-hmm. And then we built the Spring application around it. It was kind of a weird thing because I don't think like
this was the first job, no, the second.
This was the first job, yes.
The first job.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so working with it was pretty hard, but what we've done at the time was we've put significant emphasis on testing. Mm-hmm. So because we had integration tests, but also probably first and foremost, we had a lot of UI tests at that time already. We were essentially building quite high quality software at that time. We were able to complete it in like half the allocated time. Mm-hmm. And then we said, okay, so what do we do with the rest of the time? So we rewrote it. Mm-hmm. And we rewrote it with drumroll, Wicket.
Oh, this is the book with the cheese store. And Wicket was interesting. I mean,
it's still alive. It's still developing.
Yeah. But Wicket is actually, besides drum rolling, I would say it is absolute interesting because it was object-oriented way to build websites with data binding built in. And it was actually different than the other frameworks, I would say.
Yeah, I think productive. It's and, their and, primary... And
2008, right? 2008, 2009, this is the...
So the time when I was using it was closer to 2013, 2014.
Okay.
And I think their primary or the primary drive for Wicket is making web stateful. Mm-hmm. So even though, you know, everything in the browser by definition is stateless, the way that it all rolled over there was like, you know, it's a stateful application. Mm-hmm. It behaves like a stateful application, which meant that it was easier to reason about for the backend engineers. Mm-hmm. And I think this was the appeal. We didn't have frontend engineers on our team at the same time. Not everything worked very smoothly if you didn't understand the deepest things. So things were breaking in very weird ways. And then finding bugs in browsers, because this was still time where, like, you know, why does the Internet Explorer crash if I leave the application running for the weekend? For mm-hmm. instance, these were types of problems that we're trying to solve.
There was one problem with Wicket is that if you work with designers, the design has to have the same structure as the backend. So if you had nested structures in the front end, you had nested objects in the backend. And for instance, JSF didn't have this limitation, which was easier, strangely, because you could have an HTML markup, which is flat, and you have the hierarchy in the backend, so that they don't have to match. Because as I remember Wicket, you know, you had like, let's say, a form, and within the form were subforms. There were the two sub Java objects. So the expectation is that in the front end you have the same. And but I still liked Wicket, but this was the difference. Maybe even like a Python, you know, that you are forced to have a structure. So this is, yeah.
So we didn't really work with designers at that time. Okay. We were, however, very fortunate because our team lead was quite forward-thinking and he was really good with people connections, which I also, you know, I kind of aspire to replicate in my career because I can see how it works to your benefit, right? So he knew guys. One of them was a software engineer. The other one, I think, worked in a non-technical role at the Krakow office, but they were both very interested in user experience at the time when user experience was just about emerging. So they did some tests with us. They also prepared a design improvement for this system and another one that we started building in the meantime, which was kind of allowing us to change change the quality of service in real time, because the kind of assumption of this system was that there was a shared frequency with commercial carriers, and then if anything happened, the bandwidth could be taken over by the safety officers and for their benefit. Other than that, before that, you had like low quality, low resolution images because you didn't need anything more than that, right? So it was a pretty clever, and we actually ended up building a demo tool for the whole system that was switching the quality of service between the classes. So again, it never went into production, but I remember we saw a recording where the CEO of our company was clicking in our system, the demo tool, at some of the expos. At some conferences, and we could see like how very grainy video becomes like very sharp. It was a very rewarding thing to see. It was pretty fun to build that. But as, actually, like, you know, one of the things that I really realized around this time, or maybe didn't realize or didn't accept, was that I actually more liked not necessarily building the software, but how the software is built. So I was, for instance, building, I was building Install Shield installers for this software.
Do you still like it?
I still respect it.
Okay.
I think it had it was a beast as a tool, right? Mm-hmm. And then it required you to learn quite a lot about how to build installers.
You still like it, you still like to think about how to build software, or?
Oh yeah, definitely. I think it's not only software. I think it also goes beyond software and how to build teams, how to build organizations, as in thinking in systems at software companies or, you know, software providers. Understanding that it's not just a project that we're building, the system is the whole of the organization,
mm-hmm. okay.
type of a mm-hmm. thing. But at that time, it was more of a, okay, how do we make sure that these things work? So I quickly started managing our Jenkins server, how to build, you know, this installer, and kind of how to work with Maven. Maven actually was something that I really fell in love with, maybe is a strong word, but I actually liked how things are being built.
Maven is actually great. So I used a lot Java E, and the interesting part is if you use Java E and servers, the Maven is like 30 lines of code. So I use Maven. It was always minimal because I always tried to avoid external dependencies, and it never changed. And it was faster than Gradle because it was empty, no plugins, nothing. So what my Maven basically did is just compile and zip. This was all. I got the war and I could ship it. So I was actually a huge, huge fan of Maven, but I tried to be minimalistic. What I tried to avoid is, you know, super poms, inheritance, and fancy plugins. It's just bare bone Maven. It worked surprisingly well. But recently, with Java 25, what I found is that I often need executable jars with no dependencies. Mm-hmm. Just a jar which is executable. This is basically it. And Maven is a bit overkill because if you use Maven, you have to use a plugin which creates the executable jar, which I didn't like because the Maven was longer than my Java class. What I implemented, this is why I ask you whether you like building software. I built a Java build system is too much. It's just zero dependencies Java builder called Zibi, zero dependency builder. And the interesting part is it only uses built-in functionality. So it uses the built-in jar and the built-in compiler. So you don't need anything else. And what I just do, I point to a Java directory. It can be source main Java, whatever you like. And it just compiles everything and creates an executable jar. And
nice.
And I thought up, and I used it for fun because I was lazy with the Maven. Because what I did with Maven, I had a template on my GitHub account and I maintained the template. Then I cloned the template and started the project. This was my approach to a small CLI application and projects. And with the ZB, I think created this last year, what it turned out, it is extremely fast. So I didn't, without any optimizations, it can compile and build under a second a larger project, which is amazing. So I never thought about this. And Now it comes to craziness, because what I'm doing is a bit crazy, but the Zibi was fine. So I several projects and I created the jars, absolutely happy, but I wanted to have minimalistic tests. And to have a test, I thought, okay, now if I need JUnit, it's over, because I need a test dependency, you have to tell JUnit the class pass and so forth. And I said, okay, is there other way? And what I did is even crazier. I created a ZUnit, zero dependency unit runner. And this is not even a jar. This is Java 25 script. So it's like 300 lines of code is everything. So, nice. You know, you don't even have to compile it. And I implemented a hook that the ZB calls ZUnit.
Mm-hmm.
And this is crazy. So this is like sufficient for my automation projects. And now I have maybe more than 50 small projects for automation for various, from CDK to other parts. And it works perfectly. And no zero dependencies. You only need Java 25. And I don't know how often you install Java 25, but to install Java 25, to install Java 25, you only have to extract an archive. You know, there is nothing to do. It's like 1 second and you have it. So this is actually
nice.
Java 25, I have to say, is the perfect automation tool. And the other day on LinkedIn, I saw someone posted that they use Java 25 to set up Kubernetes tooling because they don't need any external dependencies. So they migrated Python scripts to Java 25. And it's also my experience because this is why I ask you about Python. I migrated recently lots of Python scripts to Java 25, and all the resulting scripts were shorter than Python. Simply, I don't know. I know Java. I have no experience with Python. I can read it a bit, but I have no idea what's going on. But what stunned me the most, all my migrations, I didn't need any external dependencies. And it seems like that Python, you always need an external dependency. So you cannot achieve a lot without an external library, which I thought, why? Because I think regex or something. So they needed, Java has it, and Python, I needed external libraries, you know. Or there was another thing. And I thought, this is strange, because I thought, you know, like Python is everything, batteries is included. You just pick Python and here we go. And it turns out, this is more Java than Python. Maybe if you don't like Java syntax, it's the other thing. But with, you know, instance methods? So what you can do with Java, you can have Sharebang instance method, and you can just run Java. You can say, for instance, hello. You can just say hello, make executable, and you have Sharebang, and it compiles in memory and runs the Java. This is basically what I'm doing, right?
Nice. I haven't really started using Java 25 that much. I read about it. Mm-hmm. There are things that I'm looking forward to, especially the stream gatherers.
Yeah.
So we used to rely a lot on Guava iterators and splitterators, mm-hmm. which are kind of like lazy execution, adds kind of, you know, the layer for lazy mm-hmm. execution of the iterators. I think it's very difficult to reason about. I always dream of, can we have a stream that is infinite, as in just always running?
Funny you
say
that. I had a discussion with Stuart Marks about that in, three episodes ago. Because I said, why streams are not reactive, you know? Because reactive would mean to me, if you hook a Java util stream to Zocket, for instance, I would, if the data arrived, I could just map filter whatever, right? But without terminal operations, could be for each which blocks, and we had a little bit because it should be doable, and you say this again, and this was actually as streams started in Java, I thought streams are this, and then I was a bit disappointed because I said, okay, come on, this is just another view to a collection. But you say this again, so I'm not crazy, which is good. You have to listen to the podcast with Stuart Marks like three episodes ago. We mentioned this briefly, or I wanted to know, you know, how hard would it be to have like reactive stream, or how to call it, an active stream, which never ends, and you just can process a data pipeline. Something like Kafka streams, you know?
Mm-hmm. So yeah, I'm kind of, you know, it excites me as an idea, right?
Yeah.
It's interesting, the zero dependency build. I would like to learn more about it. But in general, like, you know, I like Maven. I remember, like, I started playing with Maven.
Oh, this is not a replacement for Maven. This is just
another. Oh, no, I know.
This is just, if you have something executable, you can build immediately. So this is no similar.
I'm just kind of like, you know, my journey of the build tools in Java is, I remember, like,
okay,
you know,
to the journey, we have to be more organized. So your first job.
Okay, sorry.
Your first job. No problem. Your first job is the Jenkins, right? So you say you automate Jenkins, and you had end scripts to clean up, and for the Spring CRUD, which didn't work well. And
until we replace it, yeah.
And then there was the image algorithm where your CEO liked, and okay. So it seems, what you said, your first job, you didn't learn a lot, but it seems for me this was like super cool job.
It was very cool job. I learned loads and loads of things that were practical. I think the part that I was missing was we didn't have a customer.
Did always generate trouble. Without a customer is a perfect research, you know. You can learn a lot.
Yes and no, right? Because he's still operating.
Almost funny, system. Right? This was more or less joke, but yeah.
No, it's actually, it's you say it's a joke, but it's not really a joke. As in, yes, you lose the part of like, you know, how do you support people and everything like this. I've actually learned that I absolutely enjoy supporting customers. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, one of the more exciting parts of me working. And it wasn't really until the third job that I did where I was actually able to do this, because in the second place I worked at a company called Capita Employee Benefits. So this was like a subsidiary of a, well, pretty big company.
So the first job Capita. Is done. We yeah. manage all the cool stuff from the first job, and second job is complete different story, right?
Yeah, it is, because a few things change.
It's still Java.
Also Java, but also change of scenery, because after the first job, this is where I moved with my family to the UK.
Oh, the first job was in Poland?
Yeah. And then the second one was in the UK?
No.
In Krakow, yes.
Ah, okay, because I'm soon in Krakow. This is why I remember Krakow the most. It's the big conference. It's called GeekCon. So I will be there in a few weeks.
I've never been there. I've been to Confidence. I don't know whether you've
never was in Confidence. I know that it exists. In Poland, I was InfoShare, GeekCon, DevOx, JDD. Then.
Yeah, I never really was a big conference goer in Poland.
Okay.
So I never went to any while I was in Poland. I went back to Poland to join Confidence in 2019. So this was kind of the first conference that I went to.
The interesting part, I was a lot in Poland. And the reason being is the first time I was in 2008, NetBeans World Tour. And I was asked by Sun Microsystems, like, because I use NetBeans a lot, and they asked me, there's a world tour, and I had no time. And there was like Poland, Singapore, and whatever. And I took and I picked the flights to Poland, and this was easier for me than Germany, actually. So 1 hour flight, you know, there was frequent, no problem to book. It was totally easy. So okay, hey son, I go to Poland, and this was my first conference in Poland. And then from then on, I was invited a lot. Interestingly, and this NetBeans World Tour happened a lot. So there were key people. We met, you know, the organizers of GeekCon and stuff like that. And then I was invited to all other conferences, and I always said yes, because I knew there's direct flight to Gdańsk, Warsaw, but Warsaw didn't happen that much, and Krakow is it was no problem with the flights from Munich, and and yeah, still if someone says okay, there's a conference, no problem, because I know. Yeah, Cluj also similar, also great connection. Mm-hmm. So is Romania, but yeah, also very well.
But yeah, the world shrunk and connected really nicely after 2004, right? So that's the amazing part of it. And yeah, I still remember actually us joining the European Union. I'm that old, so it was only 22 years ago. So
yeah, oh, was it in 2004?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that's essentially when it became so easy to travel around the Europe.
Until 2004 was harder, so it was.
It was, yeah. You weren't really guaranteed entry every single time, stuff like that. So
wow, okay. So this is the first time I was 2008, and this was not a problem at all. It was actually a pleasant surprise. Okay, so second. Java job, what area is it? Finance, insurance.
This was flexible benefits and pension management.
Finance.
So not more people management, to be honest, or admin.
Okay.
So essentially, Capita is a company that works mostly on outsourcing of, or not mostly, but among many. Government contracts and outsourcing of HR for other companies. And part of their offering was they acquired a company to help their offering to build like a thing that helps them say, okay, so for instance, we've got employees and we want to give them, I don't know, like the, you know, life insurance or you know, how much they want to contribute to their pension. Maybe they want to buy extra holidays, because in UK there's something like this. You can buy extra holidays as part of the benefits. So you just, you know, sacrifice some of your salary to have a few more days in your
yearly or
yearly. Every year you can decide what you want to do. Or, for instance, buy a bike cheaper or have a car or car leasing type of a benefit. Essentially, there
are benefits. How much vacations can you buy?
Usually up to 5 days. It depends on the company. Okay. But yeah, so this worked pretty... The company that was acquired by Capita had already a tool in offering for this, but I quickly landed in a team that was a first team that was building a demo for it, and then a team that was building essentially the future of flexible benefit selection, which was quite interesting. We did it using event sourcing. So like we were
with
building
domain objects and
yeah.
Wow.
I really liked it because I think it was a perfect fit of a scenario, including the challenges that you can have. For instance, what happens if something needs to change with the effect 5 days ago? And then it introduces this new layer of complexity. I really love this part.
Inverse. You use Inverse Hibernate?
We used Axiom. And as a this event sourcing tool, and then I remember
back then, I had similar problems. Everyone's had, I guess. So in domain objects, on every change, you created new copy, and you have to switch the validation, the valid through, and right. You say the old is the, if you create something new, you said it is this object is valid now until the date, and the other one was from the date until the other one, like a chain of very
precisely. Yeah. But I think the idea that, so I think Axiom, the way it worked was you had the snapshots and then you had divs, so you didn't even have a full object or a full new copy. It
I
was just
never
you know,
heard about that. I only
it was just kind
inverse.
Of it was replaying things to get the state that you are in. So you had full auditing of all changes because each change was recorded as a record in the database.
Almost like Kafka.
Yeah. And then I didn't really work with Kafka much. But yeah, possibly. It's the idea I liked was, let's say that, for instance, you need to decide about, I don't know, an insurance. The insurance starts on the 1st, but you have time until the 10th to decide. So you can kind of retrospectively decide. So you can be in a state where on the 8th, you do not have the insurance, and on the 9th, you have an insurance starting on the 1st. I like this, but it made some people heads boil, as in, like, you know, how, because it adds you this, you know, the awareness layer. So there's a new dimension in the data, which is not just what the state is, but also what am I aware of at this point? And how do I amend things?
I remember
Inverse
did on Hibernate level. You had two dimensions. You could ask, you know, give me all versions for ID of a customer
as of this day.
Yeah, interesting. I remember now.
I really like this idea. I left there soon. I mean, we didn't go live with any customers by the time I was leaving. So again, these were two more years without.
Oh, which Java was it?
Customer. I don't 11. Remember. I think at that time, no, it was, I think we were doing Java 8 still and moving on to, this was a time when Java 9 was kind of coming out or about to come out. So I think we were on Java 8 at that time. So yeah, it was an interesting experience for me for many reasons. I didn't get to do the build tools at that time, but I think I got to appreciate more the kind of connection with people and learning from them. Also, this was a company where the architecture was quite well-defined, and there was a lot of dedication and commitment to quality.
Do you know Naked Objects?
No.
It was a framework project. It was a great book. It's a coffee table book, but you have to, of course, be very careful if you search for Naked Objects, Naked Object Java. And this was, I think, an Irish insurance system implemented in Java with in object-oriented way. If you search Naked Object Java, there's even a framework. And I think what you're describing, it is similar to that. tends to be an architectural pattern, but they started in Java, and they had really nice and thin book, and a little bit, you know, this is Mr. Paulson did this, and this is a little bit similar to Wicked, because what they did is the objects were the single source of truth, and from the object, the UI was automatically generated. So it was an interesting idea, and so convention of a configuration.
Yeah, interesting.
And if there's a book, buy it, because the book itself is interesting. I don't know if it's still around, because it was colorful and thin and well done. So the entire project was actually, and this was a UK project, Transformation Government Policy. And I think it was in Ireland, but yeah, long time ago. But what you are describing, I thought you was involved in the project because it's very similar to this, what you are describing.
You mean, when you say the book, you mean agile development using naked objects?
So a blue or green one, I remember, colorful. Mr. Pawson, I think. I have to also look it up.
Yeah, but Richard Pawson and Vincent Wade.
Yeah.
This is the thing that I found, yeah.
Yes, exactly. This is with the zipper from 2002.
I recall a book with a zipper. I never read it, but I think somebody showed it to me. So,
if you search on Amazon for that, there is one book which is related with the zipper, blue book, naked object, black, and the other pictures are questionable, I would say. Yeah. But, interesting concept, and if you still can get the book, get it, because, I mean, this is a... I wouldn't do this exactly this way, but it's an interesting concept.
Mm-hmm.
Because... many are saying object orientation is dead, but in specific domains, what you described right now, and interestingly, if you are modeling networks with attributes, like say you have, you know, two computers talking to each other and they're connected via a wire, and the wire or connection, and the connection can have different attributes. If you do it in object-oriented way and store it in a database, it is very simple. If you try to use it procedures or structs, I mean records and static methods, then it's going to be messy. Maybe a little bit easier with data-oriented programming Java 25, but before that, before pattern matching, it was a mess. So I would still, in some projects, you know, business projects where you need polymorphic behavior, means you go to database and as I find all vehicles and you get the subtypes of vehicles and you can implement the business logic. I mean, we are done in a few minutes, right? If you try to avoid that, you get lots of pattern matching outside the object. So it's interesting. Yeah. But my projects right now are simpler. I would say this is like what you're describing. It was like a few years ago was last time we had such a complexity and a simpler project. You don't need objects at all.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of resonates with what we were working on in the third job. So
second job is done. So you had event sourcing, you had domain objects and Axiom, you said?
Axiom with an N at the end.
Huh, I have to look it up because I never...
It's still available, but I'm Axiom. Not... Or maybe Axiom.
Without I, yeah. Axiom.
It was a long
event
time
sourcing. Ago. No kidding. Never heard about that. And they are around.
And I kind of liked good. It. It was like we had those, you know, domain object. And I remember
3,500 stars.
Creating commands. This was also like, you know, it forced nice thinking about this system that you were building. And that's something that I really appreciated about it. Also, it is not lost on me that we had a... event-driven architecture in the company, which meant that we could work with essentially full isolation from others, which meant that if we tried something like this, it wasn't messing everybody else up, right? Mm-hmm. So there were some very good decisions that people were committed to maintaining at the organization that made such experiments and such attempts possible.
But Axiom, this was actually a good tip because it's crazy popular. I never work with it. And lots of companies are using this. Even interesting one, Hyperjar. It's a company. Ford. And yeah, and this is the Java, Kotlin, and Scala framework. And this website looks very professional. Professional, not very. It looks professional. This is absolutely okay, fine. And they have white papers, well documented, popular on GitHub.
Mm.
And still active. So excellent framework. They 2 weeks ago. So it is going strong.
Oh, yeah. And they have the pricing model as well, I can see. So they have the enterprise solutions and, like, you know.
And the crazy part is the commits over time, days from 2024 to 2026 go over the roof, maybe AI, but they got from 2016 to now more active and active, which is not true to such frameworks. So it means at your time, so between 2010 and 2016, Axon was... Something happened, but not that much. From 2016 to 2024, there were more and more contributions, and the last 2 years, even more. So it is interesting framework. And there are lots of individual contributors as well. They're interesting.
I think, come to think of it, it's like because it has such a discipline, like it's built around a specific architecture, right? I think it might actually mean that this makes it easier for them to leverage.
And they are from
AI
Holland,
tools.
Looks like the main developers.
But yeah, this is just my guess. I don't know their exact, like, you know, practices and everything. But yeah, I.
The third guy is from Wrocław, Poland, and the first two committers are from Utrecht. Is.
But yeah, I remember it. I specifically remember enjoying working with it. It was nice.
Yeah, so I learned something completely new, which is extremely popular Java framework. I never heard about that, which is on 850 forks and 3,600 stars for such a framework. Infrastructure is a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And they even have IntelliJ IDEA plugin. Okay, third job becomes more and more interesting. Isn't that your current job, the third one?
No, I'm in the fourth one. So open market was the third one. So we started with the third.
Ah,
and this is the one that was... Okay. So yeah, it was a weird moment to change, as in this was just after the Brexit vote, and I didn't know whether I would still be in the UK or not. I thought, like, maybe I should just, you know, make a quick swap so that I can gather more experience. And when I landed at open market, it was an experience, as in... When I joined, just for context, I think in the first month of me being there, our oldest system, which I like to call the Moneymaker, was turning 18. It was written in Java by C++ developers. So it had quite interesting choices of how things should be built, because at the time when it was built, I think it was Java 1.2. Maybe something like this. So many things were not around. It still used an in-house built, custom modified JConnect project. So like pre-JDBC connection tools, because JDBC wasn't around when it was used. But it was a conscious decision to use Java by C++ developers, and they applied some of their patterns. They've built a lot of tools themselves. We had around 140 repositories that we're responsible for. Most of them were not being actively developed, so they were not in a very bad state, but also like a little bit rusty. But that meant that we are kind of actively working on a group of, I don't remember, 30 to 40 repositories, and we had two or three repositories that had deployables behind them. But yeah, when I joined the team that I joined, they were actually struggling quite a lot. So what happened was, a few months back, everyone that was on the team had left. There wasn't really a working CI environment. The deployments of the old system to production was essentially pull a tag on Git, Maven, clean install, skip test, kill process, start process type of a situation. So it was really scary. And my approach as a developer is, I would never trust myself with my work. So I need it absolutely scrutinized, and I need to build as much back pressure and friction as possible for me to get things wrong, right? So that yeah. the right way of doing things, going slower but with full validation or full enough validation, is absolutely essential.
Interesting that you say this, because I try to achieve the same always, but for different reasons. Without that, there's too much discussion. Is it good or right or not? And if you automate the entire thing, if the build breaks, we can decide altogether, you know, to make it different or fix it. And there is discussion is over, because it's just a machine which executes and we get the results, you know. Without that, it was endless discussion, you know. This was a good commit, review this or whatever. You have to validate as much as possible.
Yeah, so essentially just before I joined, somebody left. And they started a new Jenkins service. Before, they used Bamboo, which I don't know. Mm-hmm. I think it's still called Bamboo from Atlassian.
Yes, it is IntelliJ. Atlassian?
Yeah.
Yeah, IntelliJ is a different one. You're right. This is
yeah, and then it was still there, but we didn't really have tests ourselves in there or builds. There was something building, but nobody looked at it. The team created the Jenkins. And I think this was helpful that we had Jenkins, because it was kind of isolated, which meant that we had more freedom to do things in it. Mm-hmm. But when I joined, nobody noticed that the builds weren't running for 3 weeks. So there was a lot of learning to happen on the team, because there were so many things going wrong.
The tests were executed 3 weeks or something.
Essentially, there was a queue of 3 weeks long queue in our Jenkins.
So you bought the second Raspberry Pi, right?
Pretty much. Yeah, it's just, and it was like something silly that just blocked it, but nobody really noticed that nothing was building at that time. We had very, very talented people, but there were many, many things going wrong at that time in terms of stability. So we had like an outage every week. It took about a week to resolve. By the time we were done, we had a new outage, and it took another week. And I think it was like this for the first, I don't know, 5 months, 4 or 5 months, we didn't have a week without an outage that would take a week to resolve.
Okay.
But what that meant was that we introduced new practices, which meant if anything was going wrong, everything that was like a proactive work was going aside, and we're working to stabilize things as a team.
Yeah.
We introduced retros, essentially same day or following day retros for any incident that was happening. Even if it was still in the middle, we had to kind of do a get-together with a stakeholder. And we started slowly and painfully fixing things. So when I said that it took me 4 years to upgrade to Java 8 on the oldest system, it was because of that. Essentially, we had a lot of things to stabilize and do properly. So yeah, we built tests using test containers, I believe. Essentially, we used Docker Compose. So we were just spinning up. We containerized everything that we had, because everything was running on bare metal at that time. And then we started building various compositions of subsystems and getting them to work together and testing them, like, you know, like in this in this scenario, if this thing goes down, what happens to the rest and how do we recover? So we started building a lot of tests like this. And slowly, slowly, we went from this to as close to a zero downtime deployment as we could go using Ansible, migrated the biggest and most important things to Gradle from Maven. There was also something called Buck along the way that I got rid of within the first 2 months of being there.
Never heard about Buck.
I think it was coming from Facebook. And the idea was that you don't build things that didn't change. It's just that for Java, the only thing I remember was that out of 140 repositories, one was using Buck. And I'm usually against using something just for one use unless you intend to propagate it everywhere. And then still to deploy things, it was using Maven underneath. So deployment script was just a Maven task executed in command line, like, you know. So I got rid of that one. I migrated most of the things to Gradle for reasons. I have a complicated relationship with Gradle, but there are things that I really enjoy. And
You can program in Gradle. Respect. So Maven is less possible, right? So Gradle is DSL.
I think this is something that I'm hitting right now as well, right? So I work right now in a monorepo space. Mm-hmm. And when you're in a monorepo space and you try to decompose things from a mono build, which is not quite reliable, mm-hmm. You struggle to, how do you release things? Because if you allow your GitLab, my first assumption is like, you know, when you release to main, mm-hmm. it should be a new, or push to main, it should be a release. Mm-hmm. But if you get your GitLab or other CI of choice to actually push version changes in Maven, mm-hmm. you start getting Git commit collisions. Like, you know, this is not mm-hmm. had, that is not had. And things start failing for this reason. Because of that, I'm moving to Git-based mm-hmm. versioning. So mm-hmm. versioning based on tags. And this is where Maven struggles. Because Maven is statically configured in files, you either need to modify those files or you need to work with extensions. And extensions are kind of like, you know, special type of plugins that execute before Maven executes, and then they do some manipulation, and then they execute Maven on the manipulated version of the POM. But IDEs don't work with that.
So you mean you don't use Maven release anymore, so you don't use the Maven versions, you use the Git tags instead, right?
Yeah, there is a JGit tag extension that we use.
Yeah, exactly. I didn't use the Maven versions for a longer time because if you have wars, a similar story, you don't need the version really. So if you don't have too many external dependencies, it doesn't matter.
And but I really need the versions because we're talking right now, I'm working on like decomposing close to 300 modules and the boundaries need to fix
different
and
story.
Stuff
if you
like
have
that.
Jars dependencies, is different, but I try to avoid them. I only had, you know, like microservices and but interesting.
But yeah, so this is the fourth job, so we'll get to this in 5 minutes. But yeah, essentially, I learned.
We get
how
to this
work
next
with,
time, I guess, probably. Because what I we have to talk
nice job.
Because it's too interesting with the versions. So it'll be mm-hmm. you know what I like. I can tell you, I try to avoid branches, so main only, push it and automate whatever I can. This is my first option. And maybe it's a little bit controversial, so this is why I would like to talk with you this about that. Mm-hmm. Monorepo, super interesting. Maven, Gradle, and of course your AWS story is also interesting. And this is it will take another hour, I'm pretty sure. You are just an interesting guest.
So thank you.
Now the question is, where people can find you on the internet? So your social media, whatever you like to promote, or you have a link to something, or you know, to your profile, your company. Whatever you like.
I think it's best to follow me on LinkedIn. Mm-hmm. If I publish anything, I share over there. The reason is that I have multiple projects that I usually share on. Also, my majority of my activity is usually like circled around the AWS AI community, which was previously known as a DeepRacer community. This is part of the story for the next session.
Uh-huh.
We are available on Discord. We are publishing on LinkedIn. We are building. We are publishing in the AWS Builder Center, but also
I
we
didn't
have
know at all that
blog.
You are part of the AI community. That's interesting.
Yeah, it's. I started with DeepRacer, right? So this is the beginning of my story with AWS. Really,
is it somehow Java related as well? DeepRacer, or not at all?
No, not at all. That's why
this is a set. It... So we can cut it off, but just kidding.
Oh, I think it's actually pretty. I mean, good, good in a way, bad in a way. You know, it's it is what it is, as they say.
DeepRacer on Discord. Then what else? And on LinkedIn.
Yes, I also started a new blog, which I'm still writing for, but I find it harder and harder because whatever I write, if I don't finish it within 24 hours and like what I've written, it becomes out of date within a week with how things are changing, because I'm trying to share my learnings and it turns out that everybody's sharing the same learnings. And then like, why would I share again if everybody's mm-hmm. already done this? The blog is called Mediocris. So it's
Mediocris, cool name.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Mediocre.is. Even better. This is a perfect name. Great.
That's why I'm sticking to it, because it is actually about clouds. Mm-hmm. Because Mediocris is, I believe, average mm-hmm. in Latin.
Yeah.
And there's a cloud called Cumulus Mediocris.
Oh.
So it taps into everything that I wanted to include in the blog. So,
super cool. It was a pleasure to talk with you, to chat with you. And the next time, we cover a little bit of your fourth job and then monorepos and build systems and whatever interests you. And of course, AWS AI, if you like.
Oh, yes.
Thank you a lot. Brilliant. See you next time.
Thanks so much, Adam. Thanks.